Humans, on the other hand, can make such decisions even if we've never visited the seaside or Magic Kingdom before. Our brains can infer from past experiences that, because the kids always complain when we go camping and love watching cartoons, everyone will probably have more fun with Mickey and Goofy. How do our minds get so much from so little? Tenenbaum wrote in a paper published in the journal Science in 2011. Any parent knows, and scientists have confirmed, that typical 2-year-olds can learn how to use a new word such as horse or hairbrush from seeing just a few examples. To a 2-year-old, horses and hairbrushes have a great deal in common. The words sound similar. In pictures, they both have long bodies with a series of straight lines, in one case legs, in the other bristles, extruding outward. They come in a range of colors. And yet, though a child might have seen only one picture of a horse and used only one hairbrush, she can quickly learn the difference between those words. A computer, on the other hand, needs explicit instructions to learn when to use horse versus hairbrush. It needs software that specifies that 4 legs increases the odds of horsiness, while 100 bristles increases the probability of a hairbrush. A child can make such calculations before she can form sentences. Viewed as a computation on sensory input data, this is a remarkable feat, Tenenbaum wrote. How does a child grasp the boundaries of these subsets from seeing just one or a few examples of each? In other words, why are we so good at forecasting certain kinds of things and thus making decisions when we have so little exposure to all the possible odds? In an attempt to answer this question, Tenenbaum and a colleague, Thomas Griffiths, devised an experiment. They scoured the internet for data on different kinds of predictable events, such as how much money a movie will make at the box office, or how long the average person lives, or how long a cake needs to bake. They were interested in these events because if you were to graph multiple examples of each one, a distinct pattern would emerge. Box office totals, for instance, typically conform to a basic rule. There are a few blockbusters each year that make a huge amount of money, and lots of other films that never break even. Within mathematics, this is known as a power law distribution. Graphing other kinds of events results in different patterns. Take lifespans. A person's odds of dying in a specific year spike slightly at birth, because some infants perish soon after they arrive. But if a baby survives its first few years, it is likely to live decades longer. Then, starting at about age 40, our odds of dying start accelerating. By 50, the likelihood of death jumps each year until it peaks at about 82. Lifespans adhere to a normal or Gaussian distribution curve. Most people intuitively understand that they need to apply different kinds of reasoning to predicting different kinds of events. We know that box office totals and lifespans require different types of estimations, even if we don't know anything about medical statistics or entertainment industry trends. Tenenbaum and Griffiths were curious to find out how people intuitively learn to make such estimations. So they found events with distinct patterns, from box office grosses to lifespans, as well as the average length of poems, the careers of congressmen, which adhere to an Erlang distribution, and the length of time a cake needs to bake, which has no strong pattern. Then they asked hundreds of students to predict the future based on one piece of data. You read about a movie that has made $60 million to date. How much will it make in total? You meet someone who is 39 years old. How long will he or she live? A cake has been baking for 14 minutes. How much longer does it need to stay in the oven? You meet a U.S. congressman who has served for 15 years. How long will he serve in total? The students weren't given any additional information. They weren't told anything about power law distributions or Erlang curves. Rather, they were simply asked to make a prediction based on one piece of data and no guidance about what kinds of probabilities to apply. Despite those handicaps, the students' predictions were startlingly accurate. They knew that a movie that's earned $60 million is a blockbuster and is likely to take in another $30 million in ticket sales. They intuited that if you meet someone in their 30s, they'll probably live another 50 years. They guessed that if you meet a congressman who has been in power for 15 years, he'll probably serve another 7 or so, because incumbency brings advantages, but even powerful lawmakers can be undone by political trends. If asked, few of the participants were able to describe the mental logic they used to make their forecasts. They just gave answers that felt right. On average, their predictions were often within 10% of what the data said was the correct answer. In fact, when Tenenbaum and Griffiths graphed all of the students' predictions for each question, the resulting distribution curves almost perfectly matched the real patterns the professors had found in the data they had collected online. Just as important, each student intuitively understood that different kinds of predictions required different kinds of reasoning. They understood, without necessarily knowing why, that lifespans fit into a normal distribution curve, whereas box office grosses tend to conform to a power law. Some researchers call this ability to intuit patterns Bayesian cognition or Bayesian psychology, because for a computer to make those kinds of predictions, it must use a variation of Bayes' rule, a mathematical formula that generally requires running thousands of models simultaneously and comparing millions of results. Bayes' rule, which was first postulated by the Reverend Bayes in a posthumously published 1763 manuscript, can be so computationally complex that for centuries most statisticians essentially ignored the work because they lacked tools to perform the calculations it demanded. Starting in the 1950s, however, as computers became more powerful, scientists found they could use Bayesian approaches to forecast events that were previously thought unpredictable, such as the likelihood of a war or the odds that a drug will be broadly effective even if it has only been tested on a handful of people. Even today, though, calculating a Bayesian probability curve can, in some cases, tie up a computer for hours. At the core of Bayes' rule is a principle. Even if we have very little data, we can still forecast the future by making assumptions and then skewing them based on what we observe about the world. For instance, suppose your brother said he's meeting a friend for dinner. You might forecast there's a 60% chance he's going to meet a man, since most of your brother's friends are male. Now, suppose your brother mentioned his dinner companion was a friend from work. You might want to change your forecast, since you know that most of his coworkers are female. Bayes' rule can calculate the precise odds that your brother's dinner date is female or male based on just one or two pieces of data and your assumptions. As more information comes in, his companion's name is Pat, he or she loves adventure movies and fashion magazines, Bayes' rule will refine the probabilities even more. Humans can make these kinds of calculations without having to think about them very hard, and we tend to be surprisingly accurate. Most of us have never studied actuarial tables of lifespans, but we know, based on experience, that it is relatively uncommon for toddlers to die, and more typical for 90-year-olds to pass away. Most of us don't pay attention to box office statistics. But we are aware that there are a few movies each year that everyone sees, and a bunch of films that disappear from the theaters within a week or two. So we make assumptions about lifespans and box office revenues based on our experiences, and our instincts become increasingly nuanced the more funerals or movies we attend. Humans are astoundingly good Bayesian predictors, even if we're unaware of it. Sometimes, however, we make mistakes. For instance, when Tenenbaum and Griffiths asked their students to predict how long an Egyptian pharaoh would reign if he has already ruled for 11 years, a majority of them assume that pharaohs are similar to other kinds of royalty, such as European kings. Most people know, from reading history books and watching television, that some royalty die early in life. But, in general, if a king or queen survives to middle age, they usually stay on the throne until their hair is gray. So it seemed logical to Tenenbaum's participants that pharaohs would be similar. They offered a range of guesses with an average of about 23 additional years in power. That would be a great guess for a British king, but it's a bad guess for an Egyptian pharaoh, because 4,000 years ago people had much shorter lifespans. Most pharaohs were considered elderly if they made it to 35. So the correct answer is that a pharaoh with 11 years on the throne is expected to reign only another 12 years and then die of disease or some other common cause of death in ancient Egypt. The students got the reasoning right. They intuited correctly that calculating a pharaoh's reign follows an Erlang distribution. But their assumption, what Bayesians call the prior or base rate, was off. And because they had a bad assumption about how long ancient Egyptians lived, their subsequent predictions were skewed as well. It's incredible that we're so good at making predictions with such little information and then adjusting them as we absorb data from life, Tenenbaum told me. But it only works if you start with the right assumptions. So how do we get the right assumptions? By making sure we are exposed to a full spectrum of experiences. Our assumptions are based on what we've encountered in life, but our experiences often draw on biased samples. In particular, we are much more likely to pay attention to or remember successes and forget about failures. Many of us learn about the business world, for instance, by reading newspapers and magazines. We most frequently go to busy restaurants and see the most popular movies. The problem is that such experiences disproportionately expose us to success. Newspapers and magazines tend to devote more coverage to startups that were acquired for $1 billion, and less to the hundreds of similar companies that went bankrupt. We hardly notice the empty restaurants we pass on the way to our favorite crowded pizza place. We become trained, in other words, to notice success, and then, as a result, we predict successful outcomes too often because we're relying on experiences and assumptions that are biased toward all the successes we've seen, rather than the failures we've overlooked. Many successful people, in contrast, spend an enormous amount of time seeking out information on failures. They read inside the newspaper's business pages for articles on companies that have gone broke. They schedule lunches with colleagues who haven't gotten promoted, and then ask them what went wrong. They request criticisms alongside praise at annual reviews. They scrutinize their credit card statements to figure out why, precisely, they haven't saved as much as they hoped. They pick over their daily missteps when they get home, rather than allowing themselves to forget all the small errors. They ask themselves why a particular call didn't go as well as they had hoped, or if they could have spoken more succinctly at a meeting. We all have a natural proclivity to be optimistic, to ignore our mistakes, and forget others' tiny errors. But making good predictions relies on realistic assumptions, and those are based on our experiences. If we pay attention only to good news, we're handicapping ourselves. The best entrepreneurs are acutely conscious of the risks that come from only talking to people who have succeeded, said Don Moore, the Berkeley professor who participated in the GJP and who also studies the psychology of entrepreneurship. They are obsessed with spending time around people who complain about their failures, the kinds of people the rest of us usually try to avoid. This, ultimately, is one of the most important secrets to learning how to make better decisions. Making good choices relies on forecasting the future. Accurate forecasting requires exposing ourselves to as many successes and disappointments as possible. We need to sit in crowded and empty theaters to know how movies will perform. We need to spend time around both babies and old people to accurately gauge lifespans. And we need to talk to thriving and failing colleagues to develop good business instincts. This is hard, because success is easier to stare at. People tend to avoid asking friends who are just fired rude questions. We're hesitant to interrogate divorced colleagues about what precisely went wrong. But calibrating your base rate requires learning from both the accomplished and the humbled. So the next time a friend misses out on a promotion, ask him why. The next time a deal falls through, call up the other side to find out what you did wrong. The next time you have a bad day or you snap at your spouse, don't simply tell yourself that things will go better next time. Instead, force yourself to really figure out what happened. Then, use those insights to forecast more potential futures, to dream up more possibilities of what might occur. You'll never know with 100% certainty how things will turn out. But the more you force yourself to envision potential futures, the more you learn about which assumptions are certain or flimsy, the better your odds of making a great decision next time. Annie knows a lot about Bayesian thinking from graduate school, and she uses it in poker games. When I play against someone I've never met before, the first thing I do is start thinking about base rates, she told me. To someone who has never studied Bayes' rule, the way I play might seem like I'm prejudiced, because if I'm sitting across from, say, a 40-year-old businessman, I'm going to assume all he cares about is telling his friends he played against pros, and he doesn't really care about winning, so he'll take lots of risks. Or if I'm sitting across from a 22-year-old in a poker t-shirt, I'm going to assume he learned to play online, so he's got a tight, limited game. But the difference between prejudice and Bayesian thinking is that I try to improve my assumptions as we go along. So once we start playing, if I see that the 40-year-old is a great bluffer, that might mean he's a professional hoping everyone will underestimate him. Or, if the 22-year-old is trying to bluff every hand, it probably means he's some rich kid who doesn't know what he's doing. I spend a lot of time updating my assumptions, because, if they're wrong, my base rate is off. With Annie's brother out of the competition, there are only two players left at the Tournament of Champions table, Annie and Phil Hellmuth. Hellmuth is a card room legend, a television celebrity known as the Poker Brat. I'm the Mozart of poker, he told me. I can read other players probably better than anyone playing, maybe anyone in the world. It's white magic, instinct. Annie is at one end of the table, Hellmuth at the other. I had a good idea of how Phil viewed me at that point, Annie said later. He's told me before that he has a low opinion of my creativity, that he thinks I'm more lucky than smart, that I'm too scared to bluff when it matters. That's a problem for Annie, because she wants Phil to think she's bluffing. The only way she can lure him into a big pot is by convincing him she's bluffing, when in fact she isn't. To win this tournament, Annie needs to force Phil to change his assumptions of her. Phil, though, has a different plan. He believes he's the stronger player. He believes he can read Annie. I have this capacity to learn very, very quickly, he told me. When I know what people are doing, I can control the table. Those aren't idle boasts. Hellmuth has won 14 poker championships. Annie and Phil have roughly equal piles of chips. For the next hour, they play hand after hand, neither gaining a clear advantage. Phil keeps subtly trying to throw Annie off, to make her mad or lose her cool. I would have preferred to play your brother, he says. This is all right, Annie replies. I'm just happy to be in the finals. Annie bluffs Phil four times. I wanted him to reach the breaking point where he says, "Screw this. She's bluffing me hand after hand, and I gotta fight back," Annie said. But Phil doesn't seem shaken. He doesn't overreact. Finally, Annie gets the hand she's been waiting for. The dealer gives her a king and a nine. Phil receives a king and a seven. In the middle of the table, the dealer lays down a communal king, six, nine, and jack. Phil knows he has a pair of kings, but unbeknownst to him, Annie has two pair, kings and nines. Neither sees what the other is holding. It's Annie's bet, and she raises $120,000. Phil, thinking his pair of kings is likely the strongest hand at the table, matches it. Then, Annie goes all in, bringing the pot to $970,000. The bet is now to Phil. He starts muttering to himself. "This is unbelievable," he says out loud. "Really unbelievable. She might not even know how strong I am here. I'm not sure she fully even understands the value of the hand." He stands up. "I don't know," he says, pacing around the table. "I don't know. I have a bad feeling about this hand." He folds. Phil flips over his king, showing Annie that he had a pair. Then Annie strikes. She casually turns over one of her cards, but not both, showing Phil her pair of nines, but not revealing that she also had a pair of kings. "I wanted to force him to change his assumptions about me," Annie later said. "I wanted him to think I was bluffing with a pair of nines." "Wow, did you really just push in with a nine?" Phil says to Annie. "That's so reckless, especially against someone like me. Maybe I acted too fast." The player's ready for the next hand. Annie has $1,460,000 in chips. Phil has $540,000. The dealer gives them their cards. Annie has a king and a ten. Phil a ten and an eight. The first communal cards come out as a two, ten, and seven. Phil has a pair of tens, with an eight backing it up. It's a good hand. Annie also has a pair of tens, with a king, slightly better. Phil pushes $45,000 into the pot. Annie raises $200,000. It's an aggressive move. But Phil is starting to believe that Annie is playing recklessly. He thinks he sees a pattern he didn't expect from her. She's bluffing and bluffing and bluffing again. Phil's base rate is gradually shifting. Phil looks at the pile of chips on the table. Maybe his assumption that Annie is too scared to bluff at critical moments is wrong. Maybe Annie is bluffing right now. Maybe she's finally overplayed her hand. "I'm all in," Phil says, pushing his stack into the middle of the table. "I call," Annie says. Both players turn over their cards. "Shit," Phil says, seeing that they both have a pair of tens, and that Annie has the high card, a king to Phil's eight. The dealer puts a seven on the table, benefiting neither player. Annie is now standing, gripping her cheeks. Phil is also on his feet, breathing hard. "Give me an eight, please," he says. It's the only card that will keep him in the game. The dealer turns over the final communal card. It's a three. Annie wins the $2 million. Phil is out. The game is over. Annie is the champion. Later, she will tell people that winning this tournament changed her life. It made her, in effect, the most famous female poker player on earth. In 2010, she went on to win the National Heads Up Poker Championship. Today, she holds a record for World Series of Poker profits. In total, she's won more than $4 million. She doesn't worry about her mortgage anymore. She doesn't have panic attacks. In 2009, she appeared on a season of Celebrity Apprentice. She was a little nervous before the filming started, but not too much. There were no anxiety breakdowns. She doesn't play in many poker tournaments these days. She spends most of her time giving lectures to business people about how to think probabilistically, about how to embrace uncertainty, about how, if you commit to a Bayesian outlook, you'll make better decisions in life. A lot of poker comes down to luck, Annie told me. Just like life. You never know where you'll end up. When I checked myself into the psych hospital my sophomore year, there's no way I would have guessed I would end up as a professional poker player. But you have to be comfortable not knowing exactly where life is going. That's how I've learned to keep the anxiety away. All we can do is learn how to make the best decisions that are in front of us, then trust that, over time, the odds will be in our favor. How do we learn to make better decisions? In part, by training ourselves to think probabilistically. To do that, we must force ourselves to envision various futures, to hold contradictory scenarios in our minds simultaneously, and then expose ourselves to a wide spectrum of successes and failures to develop an intuition about which forecasts are more or less likely to come true. We can develop this intuition by studying statistics, playing games like poker, thinking through life's potential pitfalls and successes, or helping our kids work through their anxieties by writing them down and patiently calculating the odds. There are numerous ways to build a Bayesian instinct. Some of them are as simple as looking at our past choices and asking ourselves, why was I so certain things would turn out one way? Why was I wrong? Regardless of our methods, the goals are the same. To see the future as multiple possibilities rather than one predetermined outcome. To identify what you do and don't know. To ask yourself, which choice gets you the best odds? Fortune-telling isn't real. No one can predict tomorrow with absolute confidence. But the mistake some people make is trying to avoid making any predictions because their thirst for certainty is so strong and their fear of doubt too overwhelming. If Annie had stayed in academics, would any of this have mattered? Absolutely, she said. If you're trying to decide what job to take, or whether you can afford a vacation, or how much you need to save for retirement, those are all predictions. The same basic rules apply. The people who make the best choices are the ones who work hardest to envision various futures, to write them down and think them through, and then ask themselves, which ones do I think are most likely, and why? Anyone can learn to make better decisions. We can all train ourselves to see the small predictions we make every day. No one is right every time. But with practice, we can learn how to influence the probability that our fortune-telling comes true. Chapter 7. Innovation. How Idea Brokers and Creative Desperation Saved Disney's Frozen. The audience starts lining up an hour before the screening room doors open. They are directors and animators, story editors and writers, all of them Disney employees, all eager to see a rough draft of the movie everyone is talking about. As they settle into their chairs and the lights dim, two sisters appear on the screen against an icy landscape. Anna, the younger character, quickly establishes herself as bossy and uptight, obsessed with her upcoming wedding to the handsome Prince Hans and her coronation as queen. Elsa, her older sister, is jealous, evil, and cursed. Everything she touches turns to ice. She was passed over for the throne because of this power, and now, As she runs away from her family to a crystal palace high in the mountains, she nurses a bitter grudge. She wants revenge. As Anna's wedding day approaches, Elsa plots with a snarky snowman named Olaf to claim the crown for herself. They try to kidnap Anna, but their plan is foiled by the square-jawed, dashing Prince Hans. Bitter Elsa, in a rage, orders an army of snow monsters to descend upon the town and destroy it. The villagers repel the invaders, but when the smoke clears, casualties are discovered. Princess Anna's heart has been partially frozen by her evil sister, and Prince Hans is missing. The second half of the film follows Anna as she searches for her prince, desperately hoping that his kiss will heal her damaged heart. Meanwhile, Elsa prepares to attack again, and this time floods the village with vicious snow creatures. The monsters, however, are soon out of her control. They begin to threaten everyone, including Elsa herself. The only way to survive, Anna and Elsa realize, is for them to join forces. Through cooperation, they defeat the creatures, and the sisters learn that working together is better than struggling apart. They become friends. Anna's heart thaws. Peace returns. Everyone lives happily ever after. The name of the movie is Frozen, and it is scheduled to be released in just 18 months. Normally, when a movie screening ends at Disney, there's applause. Often, people cheer or shout. There are usually boxes of tissues inside the screening room because, at Disney, a good cry is the sign of a successful film. This time, there is no crying. There are no cheers. The tissues go untouched. As everyone files out, they are very, very quiet. After the screening ended, the film's director, Chris Buck, and about a dozen other Disney filmmakers gathered in one of the studio's dining rooms to discuss what they had just seen. This was a meeting of the studio's Story Trust, a group responsible for providing feedback on films as they go through production. As the Story Trust prepared to discuss the latest draft of Frozen, people served themselves from a buffet of Swedish meatballs. Buck didn't get anything to eat. "The last thing I was feeling was hungry," he told me. Disney's chief creative officer, John Lasseter, kicked off the conversation. "You've got some great scenes here," he said, and mentioned some of the things he particularly liked. The battles were thrilling. The dialogue between the sisters was witty. The snow monsters were terrifying. The film had a good, fast pace. "It's an exciting movie, and the animation is going to be amazing," he said. And then he began listing the film's flaws. The list was long. "You haven't dug deep enough," he said after detailing a dozen problems. "There's not enough for the audience to connect with, because there's no character to root for. Anna's too uptight, and Elsa's too evil. I didn't find myself liking anyone in the movie until the very end." When Lasseter was done speaking, the rest of the Story Trust chimed in, pointing out other problems. There were logical holes in the plot. Why, for instance, does Anna stick with Prince Hans when he doesn't seem like such a catch? Also, there were too many characters to keep track of. The plot twists were foreshadowed way too much. It didn't seem believable that Elsa would kidnap her sister and then attack the town without trying something less dramatic first. Anna seemed really whiny for someone who lives in a castle, is marrying a prince, and would soon be queen. One member of the Story Trust, a writer named Jennifer Lee, particularly disliked Elsa's cynical sidekick. "I effing hate Olaf," she had scribbled in her notes. "Kill the snowman." The truth was, Buck wasn't surprised by all the criticisms. His team had sensed the movie wasn't working for months. The film screenwriter had restructured the script repeatedly, first with Anna and Elsa as strangers rather than sisters, then with Elsa, the cursed sister, assuming the throne, and Anna upset at being a spare rather than an heir. The songwriters on the film, A husband and wife team behind such Broadway hits as Avenue Q and the Book of Mormon were exhausted from writing and discarding song after song. They said they couldn't figure out how to make jealousy and revenge into lighthearted themes. There were versions of the movie where the sisters were normal townspeople rather than royalty, and others where the sisters reconciled over a shared love of reindeer. In one script, they were raised apart. In another, Anna was jilted at the altar. Buck had introduced characters to explain the origins of Elsa's curse and had tried creating another love interest. Nothing worked. Every time he solved one problem, by making Anna more likable, for instance, or Elsa less bitter, dozens of others popped up. "Every movie sucks at first," said Bobby Lopez, one of Frozen's songwriters. "But this was like a puzzle where every piece we added upset how everything else fit. And we knew time was running out." While most animated projects are given 4 or 5 years to mature, Frozen was on an accelerated schedule. The movie had been in full production for less than a year, but because another Disney movie had recently collapsed, executives had moved Frozen's release date to November 2013, just a year and a half away. "We had to find answers fast," said Peter Delveco, the film's producer. "But they couldn't feel cliched or like a bunch of stories jammed together. The movie had to work emotionally. It was a pretty stressful time." This conundrum of how to spur innovation on a deadline, or, put another way, how to make the creative process more productive, isn't unique to filmmaking, of course. Every day, students, executives, artists, policymakers, and millions of other people confront problems that require innovative answers delivered as quickly as possible. As the economy changes, and our capacity to achieve creative insights becomes more important than ever, the need for fast originality is even more urgent. For many people, in fact, figuring out how to accelerate innovation is among their most important jobs. "We're obsessed with the productivity of the creative process," said Ed Catmull, president of Walt Disney Animation Studios and co-founder of Pixar. "We think it's something that can be managed poorly or well. And if we get the creative process right, we find innovations faster. But if we don't manage it right, good ideas are suffocated." Inside the Story Trust, the conversation about Frozen was winding down. "It seems to me like there's a few different ideas competing inside this movie," Lasseter told Buck, the director. "We've got Elsa's story, we've got Anna's story, and we've got Prince Hans and Olaf the Snowman. Each of those stories has great elements. There's a lot of really good material here, but you need to make it into one narrative that connects with the audience. You need to find the movie's core." Lasseter rose from his seat. "You should take as long as you need to find the answers," he said. "But it would be great if it happened soon." 2. In 1949, a choreographer named Jerome Robbins contacted his friends Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence with an audacious idea. They should collaborate on a new kind of musical, he told them, modeled on Romeo and Juliet, but set in modern-day New York City. They could integrate classical ballet with opera and experimental theater, and maybe bring in contemporary jazz and modernist drama as well. Their goal, Robbins said, should be to establish the avant-garde on Broadway. Robbins was already famous for creating theater, as well as a life, that pushed boundaries. He was bisexual at a time when homosexuality was illegal. He had changed his name from Jerome Rabinowitz to Jerome Robbins to dodge the anti-Semitism he worried would doom his career. He had named friends as communists before the House Un-American Activities Committee, terrified that if he didn't cooperate, his sexuality would be publicly revealed and he would be shunned. He was a bully and a perfectionist, and so despised by dancers that they sometimes refused to speak to him off the stage. but few refused his invitations to perform. He was widely acknowledged, revered actually, as one of the most creative artists of his time. Robbins's Romeo and Juliet idea was particularly bold, because big Broadway musicals, in those days, tended to adhere to fairly predictable blueprints. Stories were built around a male and a female lead who pushed the plot along with dialogue that was spoken, not sung. There were choruses and dancers, as well as elaborate sets and a few duets about midway through each show. The elements of plot, song, and dance, however, weren't intertwined as they were in, say, ballet, where the story and dancing are one, or opera, where dialogue is sung and music shapes the drama as much as any actor on the stage. For this new show, Robbins wanted to try something different. "Why couldn't we, in aspiration, try to bring our deepest talents together?" Robbins later said. "Why did Lenny have to write an opera, Arthur a play, me a ballet?" The three men wanted to create something that felt modern yet timeless. When Bernstein and Lawrence saw a newspaper article about race riots, they proposed making their musical about two lovers, one Puerto Rican, the other white, whose families were affiliated with warring gangs. The name of the show, they decided, would be West Side Story. Over the next few years, the men traded scripts, scores, and choreography ideas. They mailed one another drafts during their long months apart. After half a decade of work, though, Robbins was impatient. "This musical was important," he wrote to Bernstein and Lawrence. "It would break new ground. They needed to finish the script." To speed things up, he suggested, they should stop trying to do something new at every turn. Instead, they should stick with conventions they knew, from trial and error, had worked in other shows. But they should combine those conventions in novel ways. For instance, they had been wrestling with the first meeting between Tony and Maria, the musical's main characters. They should take a page from Shakespeare, Robbins suggested, and have the lovers see each other across a dance floor. But it should be made contemporary, a place where a wild mambo is in progress with the kids doing all the violent improvisation of jitterbugging. For the battle in which Tony kills his enemy, Robbins said that the choreography ought to imitate the way battles are staged in motion pictures. "The fight scene must be provoked immediately," Robbins wrote, "or else we're boring the audience." During a dramatic encounter between Tony and Maria, they needed something that echoed the classical marriage scene of Romeo and Juliet, but also incorporated the theatricality of opera and a bit of the sentimental romanticism that Broadway audiences loved. The biggest challenge, however, was figuring out which theatrical conventions were truly powerful and which had become clichés. Lawrence, for example, had written a script that was divided into the traditional three acts, "but it's a serious mistake to let the audience out of our grip for two intermissions," Robbins wrote. Motion pictures had proven that you can keep audiences in their seats if the action is always progressing. "What's more," Robbins wrote to Lawrence, "I like best the sections in which you have gone on your own path, writing in your own style, with your own characters and imagination. Least successful are those in which I sense the intimidation of Shakespeare standing behind you." Similarly, roles that were too predictable had to be avoided at all costs. "You are way off the track with the whole character of Anita," Robbins wrote to his colleagues. "She is the typical downbeat, blues, torch-bearing second character," he remarked. "Forget Anita." By 1957, 8 years after they had first embarked on the project, the men were finally done. They had combined different kinds of theater to create something new. A musical where dance, song, and dialogue were integrated into a story of racism and injustice that was as contemporary as the newspapers sold outside the theater doors. All that was left was to find financial backers. Nearly every producer they approached turned them down. The show was too different from what audiences expected, the money men said. Finally, Robbins found financiers willing to support a staging in Washington, D.C., far enough from Broadway, everyone hoped, that if the show bombed, the news might not spread to New York. The method Robbins suggested for jump-starting the creative process, taking proven conventional ideas from other settings and combining them in new ways, is remarkably effective, it turns out. It's a tactic all kinds of people have used to spark creative successes. In 2011, two Northwestern University Business School professors began examining how such combinations occur in scientific research. Combinations of existing material are centerpieces in theories of creativity, whether in the arts, the sciences, or commercial innovation, they wrote in the journal Science in 2013. And yet most original ideas grow out of old concepts, and the building blocks of new ideas are often embodied in existing knowledge. Why are some people so much better at taking those old blocks and stacking them in new ways, the researchers wondered. The researchers, Brian Uzi and Ben Jones, decided to focus on an activity they were deeply familiar with, writing and publishing academic papers. They had access to a database of 17.9 million scientific manuscripts published in more than 12,000 journals. The researchers knew there was no objective way to measure each paper's creativity, but they could estimate a paper's originality by analyzing the sources authors had cited in their endnotes. A paper that combines work by Newton and Einstein is conventional. The combination has happened thousands of times, Uzi told me. But a paper that combines Einstein and Wang Chong, the Chinese philosopher, that's much more likely to be creative, because it's such an unusual pairing. Moreover, by focusing primarily on the most popular manuscripts in the database, those studies that had been cited by other researchers thousands of times, they could estimate each manuscript's creative input. To get into the top 5% of the most frequently cited studies, you have to say something pretty new, Uzi said. Uzi and Jones, along with their colleagues Satyam Mukherjee and Mike Stringer, wrote an algorithm to evaluate the 17.9 million papers. By examining how many different ideas each study contained, whether those ideas had been mentioned together previously, and if the papers were popular or ignored, their program could rate each paper's novelty. Then they could look to see if the most creative papers shared any traits. The analysis told them that some creative papers were short, others were long. Some were written by individuals, the majority were composed by teams. Some studies were authored by researchers at the beginning of their careers, others came from more senior faculty. In other words, there were lots of different ways to write a creative study. But almost all of the creative papers had at least one thing in common. They were usually combinations of previously known ideas mixed together in new ways. In fact, on average, 90% of what was in the most creative manuscripts had already been published elsewhere and had already been picked over by thousands of other scientists. However, in the creative papers, those conventional concepts were applied to questions in manners no one had considered before. Our analysis of 17.9 million papers spanning all scientific fields suggests that science follows a nearly universal pattern, Uzi and Jones wrote. The highest impact science is primarily grounded in exceptionally conventional combinations of prior work, yet simultaneously features an intrusion of unusual combinations. It was this combination of ideas, rather than the ideas themselves, that typically made a paper so creative and important. If you consider some of the biggest intellectual innovations of the past half century, you can see this dynamic at work. The field of behavioral economics, which has remade how companies and governments operate, emerged in the mid-1970s and 80s When economists began applying long-held principles from psychology to economics, and asking questions like why perfectly sensible people bought lottery tickets. Or, to cite other juxtapositions of familiar ideas in novel ways, today's internet social networking companies grew when software programmers borrowed public health models that were originally developed to explain how viruses spread and applying them to how friends share updates. Physicians can now map complicated genetic sequences rapidly because researchers have transported the math of Bayes' rule into laboratories examining how genes evolve. Fostering creativity by juxtaposing old ideas in original ways isn't new. Historians have noted that most of Thomas Edison's inventions were the result of importing ideas from one area of science into another. Edison and his colleagues used their knowledge of electromagnetic power from the telegraph industry, where they first worked, to transfer old ideas to the industries of lighting, telephone, phonograph, railway, and mining, two Stanford professors wrote in 1997. Researchers have consistently found that labs and companies encourage such combinations to spark creativity. A 1997 study of the consumer product design firm IDEO found that most of the company's biggest successes originated as combinations of existing knowledge from disparate industries. IDEO's designers created a top-selling water bottle, for example, by mixing a standard water carafe with a leak-proof nozzle of a shampoo container. The power of combining old ideas in new ways also extends to finance, where the prices of stock derivatives are calculated by mixing formulas originally developed to describe the motion of dust particles with gambling techniques. Modern bike helmets exist because a designer wondered if he could take a boat's hull, which can withstand nearly any collision, and design it in the shape of a hat. It even reaches to parenting, where one of the most popular baby books, Benjamin Spock's The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, first published in 1946, combined Freudian psychotherapy with traditional child-rearing techniques. A lot of the people we think of as exceptionally creative are essentially intellectual middlemen, said Uzi. They've learned how to transfer knowledge between different industries or groups. They've seen a lot of different people attack the same problems in different settings, and so they know which kinds of ideas are more likely to work. Within sociology, these middlemen are often referred to as idea or innovation brokers. In one study published in 2004, a sociologist named Ronald Burt studied 673 managers at a large electronics company and found that ideas that were most consistently ranked as creative came from people who were particularly talented at taking concepts from one division of the company and explaining them to employees and other departments. People connected across groups are more familiar with alternative ways of thinking and behaving, Burt wrote. The between-group brokers are more likely to express ideas, less likely to have ideas dismissed, and more likely to have ideas evaluated as valuable. They were more credible when they made suggestions, Burt said, because they could say which ideas had already succeeded somewhere else. This is not creativity born of genius, Burt wrote. It is creativity as an import-export business. What's particularly interesting, however, is that there isn't a specific personality associated with being an innovation broker. Studies indicate that almost anyone can become a broker, as long as they're pushed the right way. Before rehearsals began for West Side Story, Robbins went to his colleagues and said he was dissatisfied with the musical's first scene. As initially envisioned, the show opened in a traditional manner with the play's characters introducing themselves via dialogue that illustrated the plot's central tensions. Act 1, Scene 1. Arab, a teenager dressed in the uniform of his gang, the Jets, comes across the stage. Suddenly, two dark-skinned boys plummet down from a wall, crashing Arab to the ground and attacking him. The attackers run off, and then several boys, dressed like Arab, run on from the opposite side. Diesel. It's Arab. Baby John. He was hit hard. Action. And right on our own turf. Riff, the leader of the Jets, enters. Riff. Straight factualities, Arab. Who did it? Action. Those buggin' Puerto Ricans. Diesel. We're supposed to be the champions in this area. Mouthpiece. The PRs are crowding us like their lousy families are crowding ours. Arab. Let's have some action, Riff. Action. Let's put it on the PRs. Baby John. A rumble. Riff. Whoa, buddy boys. What do you diapers know from rumbles? The state of your ignorance is appalling. How do you think the top brass go about a war? Baby John. Cracko, Jacko. Riff. First, you dispatch scouts to the enemy leader to arrange a war council. Then, action. Then you go. Riff. We ought to get Tony so we can take a vote. Action. He always does what you say anyway. Come on. In this version of the opening scene, the audience has learned the basics of the plot within moments of the curtain's rise. They know there are two gangs divided along ethnic lines. They know these gangs are engaged in an ongoing battle. They know there is a hierarchy within each gang. Riff is clearly the leader of the Jets, as well as a certain formality. A rumble can't occur without a meeting of the War Council. The audience feels the energy and tension. Cracko, Jacko! And they learn about another character, Tony, who seems important. All in all, an effective opening. Robbins discarded it. Too predictable, he said. Lazy and cliched. Gangs don't just fight. They own territory, the same way a dancer owns a stage. The opening number of a musical about immigrants and the energy of New York ought to feel ambitious and dangerous. It needed to make the audience feel the same way Robbins, Bernstein, and Lawrence had felt when they had come up with this idea. They, the playwrights themselves, were strivers, Robbins told them. They were Jews and outcasts, and this musical was an opportunity to draw on their own experiences of exclusion and ambition and put their own emotions on the stage. Robbins could be brutal, said Amanda Vale, Robbins's biographer. He could sniff out creative complacency and force people to come up with something newer and better than what everyone else settled for. Robbins was an innovation broker, and he forced everyone around him to become brokers as well. This is what appeared on stage, and later on movie screens, in what eventually became known as the West Side Story Prologue. It is one of the most influential pieces of theater in the last 60 years. The opening is musical, half-danced, half-mimed. It is primarily a condensation of the growing rivalry between two teenage gangs, the Jets and the Sharks, each of which has its own prideful uniform. The Jets, sideburned, long-haired, are vital, restless, sardonic. The Sharks are Puerto Ricans. The stage opens with the Jets on an asphalt court, snapping their fingers as the orchestra plays. A handball strikes the fence, and the music stops. One of the boys, Riff, indicates with a nod to return the handball to its frightened owner. Riff's subordinate complies, and the music restarts. The Jets saunter across the court, and as the music swells, they pirouette. They cry, "Yeah!" and begin a series of rondes de jambes en l'air. They own this asphalt. They are poor and ignored by society, but right now, they own this space. A teenager, the leader of the Sharks, appears. The Jets stop moving. Other Sharks appear, and they start snapping, and then whirl in a series of pirouettes of their own. The Sharks declare their own ownership of the stage. The two gangs skirmish, contesting territory and dominance, pantomiming threats and apologies, competing but never outright fighting, until dozens of sharks and jets are flying across the stage, almost, but never touching, as they taunt and challenge each other. Then a shark trips a jet. The jet pushes his attacker. A cymbal starts chiming, and everyone is suddenly atop each other,